You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Get started on your painting project this summer and save big money at Menards. Rust-Oleum Stops Rust 5-in-1 Spray Paint lets you choose from 5 unique spray patterns with a twist of the dial, so you can get a professional, corrosion-resistant finish on every project. Save big money on Rust-Oleum Spray Paint now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is a writer, editor, and author with bylines at, deep breath, The New York Times, New York Magazine, The Los Angeles Times, Rolling Stone, NPR, GQ, Vanity Fair, Vogue, Pitchfork, Variety, Refinery 29, Paper Magazine, and more. That's not even all of them, you guys. But most importantly, she is the author of the book Nora Ephron at the Movies, a visual celebration of the writer and director behind When Harry Met Sally, You've Got Mail, Sleepless in Seattle, and more, which was released last fall to tremendous acclaim by Abrams Books. Good publisher there. Please welcome the witty, the wise, the wonderful Miss Alana Kaplan. Hi, Alana.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. And I, you know, the release of the book timed out weirdly to the sort of wind down of the previous show. So I'm glad we were able to finally get you on. I wish we could have had it. There's never been a more appropriate release date than for a Nora Ephron compendium to come out in the fall. So I feel bad that we missed it, but I'm glad we're finally having the chance to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. Just glad I'm here.
Yeah. So this Nora Ephron at the Movies was your first book. Yeah. So talk to me about that experience now that it's been out for a little while, because I, you know, as we met, you do a lot of freelance writing online and for print. I find it to be such a wonderfully separate experience from the kind of grind of quick turn online and print writing. How did you find the process for you this first time out?
I mean, I think it was challenging, to be honest. I feel like, and I don't know if maybe the first time you wrote a book, you felt like this, but there's no one really giving you an explanation of how things work. So yep. It was a lot of just like trial and error, and it is a very isolating process. And I think my favorite parts of it were when I got to like interview other people, because after a while you're just like, oh my God, I'm so over just being by myself. I like, cause it is really, it's just solitary, and like, that's really yes. nice sometimes, but I feel like it was nice to interact and like build storytelling through other people too. It was definitely an interesting experience for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. I think that it, you know, like I have a lot of pride in doing it because I wasn't sure I could. Like I was really anxious to even start writing because I had never done something like this. And I kept being like, I'm not going to do it right. So the fact that I finished it, I also wrote it while I was planning my wedding and I was working and freelancing at the same time, like a day job and freelance. Like it was just, wow. It was a lot. So like the fact that it's completed and it is something I'm proud of is great. I also don't know that, like, I'm not sure if you've ever felt like this, but you know, writing this book, I'm like, I know I wrote it, but it feels like another person wrote it.
Yeah. Yeah, That's yes. And I think part of that too is that sort of bubble isolation experience where it feels like, well, the person I was with that entire time must have been the one who went and wrote that book when we were done talking about it. At risk
when
of
you're
asking
moved on to another thing, like you're working on another project or you're thinking about something else, and you're just like you're just as into the next thing as you were into that thing when it was happening. So mm-hmm. then like it is kind of like a different person. I mean, it's yeah. a whole different. Because, like, when I'm working on a thing, I'm walking around thinking about it all day long. You know, especially as you're, like, sort of getting deeper and deeper into it. You're really clear on all of the problems with it at some point. Like, mm-hmm. it's sort of hard to think about anything else. And in a way, when you've moved on to something else and you're thinking now about that thing all day long, there is... I never thought about it that way, but there is an element of just, like... it might not feel like it to anybody else, but it feels like it to me.
I feel like it's also when you're going through all of the like emotions with it, there's really like, yes, people can relate to the process of writing a book, but like no one can really relate to the issues that you're going through with this book, with a yes. your book.
Yes.
So it's interesting.
Yes. Well, and because literally every single subject offers their own challenges, and conundrums and dilemmas and questions of how you're going to get around things and through certain things. At risk of asking the question, I'm sure everyone on your press tour asked, what made you decide to take on this particular filmmaker as a subject for this sort of comprehensive study?
So, I mean, I grew up, loving rom-coms, and one of the earlier rom-coms I saw was You've Got Mail. And mm-hmm. that was kind of my path gateway into Nora Ephron. And I used to watch like marathon when like TBS and TNT would always do really great movie marathons and rom-com marathons. And I just found myself like sucked into, you know, the You've Got Mail, When Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle marathons. And she became one of my favorite filmmakers. It also happened to be that I was – one of my beats was just, like, covering rom-com oral histories, and an editor at Abrams had seen my – I think it was my oral history of either Almost Famous or 10 Things I Hate About You, and mm-hmm. they reached out, and they were looking for someone who might be interested in writing this book, and I jumped at the opportunity.
That then it worked out. Were there any assumptions or sort of ideas that you had about her going in that writing the book changed your mind about or sort of reconfigured your thinking around?
Her work, if you're watching one of her rom-coms, it's easy to conflate her her as a person with the work she did in her rom-coms and think she's really saccharine. And
sure.
I feel like writing this book was a big reminder that Nora as a person was not like that. She was very yeah. tough. And I think, you know, she could be sharp. She could skewer you with words. And I think it was interesting hearing stories from people who collaborate with her, even the people closest with her, to her, who, you know, really drilled down that she was very tough and she could be really mm-hmm. tough. And like, as much as they could admire her, they could also point out the reality that, like, you know, there were different facets to her.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. And I think a lot of times because the rom-coms, the sort of the sweet rom-coms were so ubiquitous and so massively popular that people don't realize, you know, that there's like, it's not just that there's like, you know, darkness and cynicism in a lot of the short story writing and stuff like that. Like some of the movies, the ones that were not as big a hits, but things like Mixed Nuts or was it Lucky Numbers? Was that the John Travolta one? These are like dark comedies that are dealing with sort of darker themes and subject matters. And so, yeah, that's a really interesting point that there was a lot more to her voice and her worldview than sort of what we immediately flash on when we hear that name.
Yep.
Miss Ephron had not yet begun directing when Guide for the Film Fanatic was published in 1986. So we couldn't have you select something from her filmography. So what did you select to discuss with us today instead?
16 candles.
So, I mean, what's the story? I mean, you got a guy or?
Yes, three big ones and they left went bled.
Her name is Samantha Baker, and today is her 16th birthday.
Red, she's gotten her booty.
Oh, I'd better go get my magnifying glass.
They forgot my birthday. Classic. This is the single worst day of my entire life.
Universal Pictures presents...
Score, a direct hit.
16 Candles.
It is wild how, like, watching them sell this movie that there was not really a template for at the moment. They're really, you could tell that Universal also put out Fast Times. Like, this is a very Fast Times flavored trailer.
Jake's my boy! Jake is a senior.
Jake's my boy! I love that part.
Perfect.
He doesn't even know you exist.
He smiles at me and I don't say anything. Can't believe I'm such a jerk.
Like, when a person says, this is the worst day of my life, they don't usually mean because I got felt up by my grandma. You know what? You might be right. That might, you know what?
You might be right.
Give you that.
It might not get worse than that.
What's happening? Hot stuff.
His name is Long Duck Dong.
Nothing could shock me anymore.
Underpants. Can I borrow your underpants for 10 minutes?
Baby John Cusack. Baby Joan Cusack.
Hate that rock and roll rubbish.
Everybody in this family has just gone totally out of limits.
You guys, you just gotta be cool. You just gotta chill out and just be cool. Just watch me.
Why, you little scuzzbag.
I'll let you take Carolyn home. She's so blitz, she won't know the difference.
Jake, I don't have a car.
I mean... all the problematic stuff is in the trailer too. We'll circle around
trailer.
All of that.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like genuinely representing the well representing the movie, you know,
it doesn't.
I feel like they're not lying. You know,
nope,
they're not giving you the whole thing. There's lots there, but
yes,
you know what you're in for.
You do.
Is either on her case,
Nina, you're the one I want to bug, huh?
Or out of their tree.
Monday!
It only happens once in a lifetime.
This has got to be a joke.
And once is enough.
Happy birthday, Samantha.
Showing you the ending.
16 candles.
Spoiler warning. All right, so 16 Candles was the directorial debut of Mr. John Hughes, who had made a name for himself as a regular contributor to National Lampoon magazine, which he parlayed into his first screenwriting credit for National Lampoon's Class Reunion. But he had his first hit with the adaptation of his piece Vacation 58, which was published in the magazine's September 1979 issue, which became the smash 1983 comedy National Lampoon's Vacation. That same year, his script for Mr. Mom turned into another hit, so he signed a three-picture deal with Universal Pictures, and 16 Candles was the first film of that deal. It was, of course, the first of several mid-80s teen-centered comedy dramas written and or directed by Mr. Hughes. All right, Mike, what does Danny Perry say about 16 Candles in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Danny says,
Samantha Baker, Molly Ringwald, has her sweet 16th birthday, but her parents and, amazingly, even her visiting grandparents have forgotten it due to the hoopla surrounding her older sister's marriage. Contributing to her torment is her unrequited love for a handsome senior, Michael Scheffling, who's taking
right,
his
yes.
beautiful blonde girlfriend Haviland Morris to the big dance and beer bash. It seems to her that the only person who knows she exists and sees that she's special is a gawky sophomore, the geek, Anthony Michael Hall, near whom she doesn't want to be seen, but who keeps making a play for her in public, totally humiliating her. However, during the course of this eventful day, night, following morning, she'll discover that the geek is a neat guy, a good friend with the same insecurity she has, and that Scheffling also has eyes for her. Director-writer John Hughes has moderate success making a comedy out of teenage angst, pain, and insensitivity. Even heroine Ringwald can be cruel as she reveals in her insults toward Hall. There is much teenage interplay and many teenage types that you'll recognize if you have any contact with high school kids, and Hughes also has an ear for teenage lingo. Characters who start out as smart and witty eventually become stupid and offensive, as in most teen sex comedies. Hughes' mistake is to forsake Samantha for supporting characters, for as long as Ringwald is on the screen, the film is first rate. Ringwald is absolutely fantastic, presenting a real special teenager. She's especially funny when reacting through facial expressions, particularly lifting her upper lip, body language, eye movements, and voice nuances to each aggravation and disappointment. Hughes would reunite Ringwald and Hall for The Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink, which he produced. Also with Paul Dooley, George Watanabe, Blanche Baker, Karen Glynn, Edward Andrews, Billy Bird, Justin Henry, and John Cusack.
So we have I think it's the first one we spotted, a rare error in Guide for the Film Fanatic, because he says that he reunited Ringwald and Hall for Pretty in Pink, but Anthony Michael Hall is not in Pretty in Pink. He's I think he's conflating Anthony Michael Hall with John Cryer, which
that's easy to do.
That's easy to do. That's fairly easy to do, I suppose. Not now. Now that Anthony Michael Hall is like weirdly jacked, but at the time, yes, definitely playing in the same sort of pool there. All right. So Alana, why this particular movie? Why was this the one out of the 1600 plus that you wanted to talk with us about on the show?
This is actually, I believe, the first rom-com I ever watched.
Oh, wow.
Because my mom was obsessed with Molly Ringwald movies. And so any time that 16 Candles was on, she'd make me watch it with her. So it kind of felt fitting. I was actually looking for, in that list, Mermaids, because that's one of my favorite movies from, I think it's 1990.
It's 90. Yeah.
So I was like, but I love 16 Candles. I love aspects of 16 Candles now as an adult. It's obviously mm-hmm. very problematic in a lot of ways, but there's still, you know, I really love the coming of age story. And I feel like Jake Bryan is such an iconic character just to a generation of, I would say, like Gen X boomer mm-hmm. women, that mm-hmm. it's like, he's kind of the blueprint for a lot of other like hot, like popular guys in teen movies. So,
yes.
That's kind of the gist for me.
All right. Well, you touched on this. So let's deal with it up top. Let's handle the elephant in the room and then we'll talk about the fun stuff. Some of it, yes, has aged rather poorly. There are some slurs that we don't use in polite company anymore.
Wait, do you use them in rude company?
That's fair enough. there are some slurs that we don't use. How's that? The entire Long Duck Dong thing, especially the gong, is a little troubling. The she's so blitzed you won't know the difference, that whole piece of it is a little but this is, I think, you know, a fine opportunity to sort of, I mean, this is sort of, I think, an ongoing question when we're talking about popular art like movies, where things change and sort of our societal norms change and what we're how we deal with certain issues shifts. Like, what is your sort of approach when you're thinking about and looking at, you know, hashtag problematic art?
I think that you can appreciate the art for, you know, the more positive aspects that it gave culture and how it influenced sure. other filmmakers and other actors and other writers. But I think that, you know, while doing that, you need to acknowledge where the piece of art fell short. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, when you grapple with that, you can kind of talk about in terms of like the culture, like how, you know, we've seen this movie kind of as a launching pad for other, you know, teen sex comedies that are maybe, you know, a little bit better about consent or, you know, yeah. less offensive in many ways. So I think that it's something that you know, like you don't ignore, but you have to acknowledge like the problems with it.
Sure. I think it's also with this one, I think really important to contextualize it within sort of what was happening in mainstream movie comedy at that time. Like, when we talk about 16 Candles, we're often sort of framing it the way that I did in the summary a little bit ago as sort of like the beginning of this specific thing, which it definitely was. This is like the John Hughes teen comedy became a really big part of movie culture really quickly. And a lot of sort of imitators or, you know, sort of adjacent stuff kind of came about as well. But this movie did not come out of the ether. That, you know, the 80s teen sex comedy was very much a thing in the years leading up to this. And a lot of the stuff, and you know, and I'm so used to thinking about 16 Candles as this starter pistol that you forget until you watch it again how much of the stuff that's in it is stuff that was sort of the tropes.
It's not all Ferris Bueller. It's got some Porky's right in it too, which, like,
yes,
I did not see coming. I'd never seen this movie before. My wife clowned me mercilessly for never having seen 16 Candles before, you know. So I thought I was expecting much more of a Ferris Bueller, and like, you know, she says, like, they forgot my fucking birthday, and like the first 2 minutes I was like, whoa, what? Where did that come from? I never heard Kermit the Frog say fuck before. What are we doing here, you know?
Yeah, that's a great smash to title edit.
It's a really it was a really good moment too. I mean, it was a really, like, it was a really sharp, you know, sort of intro moment. I did not see the fuck word coming at all.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's a lot of, you know, you're right, the Porky's comparison is apt. Like, you know, that there are movies like, you know, Losing It and Making the Grade and, you know, My Tutor and all of these.
There's a lot of like girls' underwear business in this movie it feels very Porky's sort of, you know, washout.
But even, you know, the sort of the wild, out of control, drunken teenage party was like very, I mean, like that is being your sort of main motivator of action in the second half of your movie. Like that was fairly common as well in that era. None of those movies, or very few of those movies, had the sort of romanticism that this one gets into, which I think is sort of what made it special. Talk to me about Molly Ringwald, Alana. What do you think she's doing here that's so interesting? And why was your mom so drawn to her, I guess, would be the first question.
I mean, she was like one of the main Brat Pack girls. She was at the helm, and she, I feel like for many women of that time, was like the Taylor Swift of that era to some degree in terms of like popular cultural icon. I think in this movie, you know, she plays someone who's very relatable in terms of like the innocence of, you know, being a teen on the precipice of what feels like adulthood. And she also does she's so endearing as this like bratty teen at the same time that she just plays the sincerity and the...
No, I mean, yeah, her line readings are so dry and so funny. She's got her comic timing is like crackerjack.
Yeah. And I think that is, you know, why you can't really look away when she's on screen. She's just that captivating, even though there are so many, you know, different things, so many subplots, so many different chaotic things happening in her life. I also think, you know, I feel like she plays like the middle child so well in terms of like this family dynamic. And I feel like them forgetting her family, entirely forgetting her birthday, is just like classic middle child syndrome. so it's just, yeah, I felt like it was, you know, different than like Porky's or something. Like this was also geared more towards women, I would say, which is kind of ironic. Obviously it was during of that time, but like it like glamorizes 80s rape culture at the same time, which is ironic because this is
right.
definitely, you know, probably more seen as a chick flick too, as right. well as a sex comedy. So, right. yeah.
But they all kind of did that. And I think, you know, Jason, you make a very good point that, like, you know, Revenge of the Nerds doesn't have, like, a serious, relatable, like, genuine romantic relationship in the middle of it that we're all sort of on board for. I mean, I don't know if any of the other ones even tried to do that. And this movie, when you think about it, like, it is, there's a lot more of that. Mm-hmm. Than there is, you know, in the kind of way that in some ways, and I have no idea, this is just me purely making something up. It sort of feels like he wanted to make the Molly Ringwald movie and the studio was sort of like, look, we got to have some boobs and a big beer party or yeah, this we're not going to be able to make a trailer out of this movie. And the right. sort of balance of the two things, you yeah. know, I mean, the whole rape culture storyline, that was probably in the first draft of the script. Right. Yeah. But a lot of the other stuff does feel not necessarily tacked on, but it's not the focus at any point. Even when right. you're at the party, it's, you know, what does it become? It becomes the scene in the garage or whatever. Right. Like even when you're sort of in those moments, he uses them for something deeper than that. Right. Deeper than the boobs. But there's boobs. This is Ferris Bueller with boobs. I did not see Ferris Bueller with boobs on the horizon at all.
We should talk about that. I don't, just specifically the idea that like that this may be for my money, the last R-rated PG rated movie, if that makes any sense. Like, because there's, you know, the one F bomb that PG-13's got, there are boobs, which were not in PG movies. Typically, this movie was released in May of 1984. So it came out 2 months before the introduction of the PG-13 rating. So, you know, if this is released 2 months later, it's a PG-13. And the two movies that are always discussed as sort of prompting the PG-13 were Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and Gremlins, both of which came out in like June of 84. But I feel like this one must have been part of the conversation as well, because that is a thing you still hear people talk about, is how, what a not PG PG rated movie this is.
Totally agree with that. I think it's funny how the rating system has shifted over the years. Just like looking back, and also, you know, I was looking back at like the month this came out, and I honestly don't know this, but like if it was maybe, I don't know, like set up to fail too, because it was Indiana Jones came out that month, but like everything else, and maybe it's just because like I have never seen those movies, but that month there wasn't really anything else. But that year, I feel like there were several, you know, great films that came out. So I don't know.
Yeah, it was a big summer. And if you'd like to hear more about those summer movies, listen to our 1984 episodes of A Very Good Year. Let's talk a little bit about Anthony Michael Hall, who I think is just, I forget how great he is in this movie. What I love about the Anthony Michael Hall performance is the misplaced confidence of it. He is so certain of himself, which is not a concept that it's not a quality that we typically see in our on-screen geeks and nerds. It separates it from the nerd role that he would play in The Breakfast Club the following year. I read something about how, you know, some actors you've heard of came in to read for this, and Hugh said that they were all doing like, you know, the sort of like the glasses with the masking tape and the pocket protector, and were really playing the nerdy thing. And that what made Anthony Michael Hall stand out was the confidence that he had, was him choosing to play it as if this guy is a geek and thinks he's the coolest guy on the planet, which I think is such an interesting choice. What do you think of Anthony Michael Hall in this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think that choice was interesting too. And I think that's what makes him more charming to the viewers, even when he's being despicable. Mm-hmm. Like you're still kind of rooting for him in a weird way. And I don't know that anyone else could have played it that way. Yeah. I love that he's kind of the king of the nerds.
Yes. And they treat him as such. And then, you know, the other performance that I was really struck by on this viewing that I hadn't made a lot of notice of before, this actress Blanche Baker, who plays her sister, her older sister Jenny, who's getting married, starts as kind of a nothing role. And then in the third act, really becomes the comic MVP, as far as I'm concerned. Like when all the other subplots are sort of getting more serious and more connected and more sort of emotional, she gets this physical comedy opportunity with the sedatives that she has taken, and absolutely crushes it. She is really funny, really agile, and really interesting. It's not something that I had really taken notice of before. Where do you land on her work, Alana?
I just think the muscle relaxers element,
yes,
just adds so much to the yes, third act, and you know, it really does make her character come to life. And the yeah, fact that she took four of them, and like, I don't know, four muscle relaxers, but I'm like, is that like really what would happen? But she just, I don't know, she just becomes more human. And I think like that's so important for her relationship dynamic with Samantha.
Yeah.
And you know, like the way that the movie unfolds at the end. And I think that it seems like she's not really going to be a huge part of it. She's taking up so much space on right, her own in the beginning. And then at the end, it's like, it's really necessary for, you know, her to have, you know, this moment with her sister, and also to just like, there's obviously like a lesson that comes out of it for Sam. Mm-hmm. And so I really like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's such a smart subversion to have a character that is presented as this sort of perfect porcelain doll almost, and then to have her like turn into one of the Three Stooges at the end of the movie is just like, is so unexpected. I was in fact so taken by her work that for the first time, of any of the times I've watched this movie, I thought to myself, who was this? What else did she do before this? What else did she do after? Here's what I found out. Blanche Baker was the daughter of the actress Carol Baker, who first gained infamy for playing the title role in Ilya Kazan's Baby Doll. And her father was Jack Garfine, who directed the 1961 movie Something Wild, starring Carol Baker, which is one of the great sort of like early New York indies. It's this really stark, difficult kind, you know, trauma melodrama thing that's available in the Criterion Collection. It's pretty easy to see, and it's a terrific movie. So just the idea that this actress came out of this union of these two really tremendous, creative, independent people, I thought was really, really tremendous. Michael, God, and I'm going to screw up the name too. Michael Scheffling, who plays Jake. You touched on this earlier, Alana. Talk to me about the appeal of Jake, the character, and of Michael Scheffling, the actor.
I feel like he's this all-American guy who's like rich, popular,
and immaculate sweater vest taste.
Yes, exactly. And like the thing is, the movie makes it seem like he has the softer side because he's like taking an interest in Samantha, but then his actions, if you really think about it now, are like truly awful.
Yeah.
But there was still such an, like, he was just like such a hunk, like, mm-hmm, of that time. And I feel like part, you know, like, I loved him too. Like, my mom loved him. Like, and I've had a fascination with him for a long time. But, like, he is also the, you know, the romantic lead in Mermaids too. Yes.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So I, you know, he, this was his like defining role. It didn't even matter what he, you know, did or said in this role. He was like everyone wanted him at, after watching this movie. And I think, you know, he played really great, like brooding guy who, you know, like was maybe interested in someone who wasn't as popular as him. And, and that's where, like, you know, I feel like that's where you're like, oh, like this is charming. He's like, it's a little bit more of an empathetic figure. And but
well, and that also becomes a wish fulfillment sort of thing for the viewer. Like if this impossibly handsome man could be attracted to someone who is, you know, not, you know, in his league or what have you, then maybe someone who I am infatuated with, who's out of my league, could fall for me. Like it becomes a very easy sort of situation to place yourself in. So of course you're going to like him. Of course you're going to be empathetic to him.
Yeah. And I know his career was short-lived in Hollywood. It wasn't for him. So we only got a couple of projects out of him, but some great ones.
Yeah. Left a mark on little Alana, clearly. And then finally, I have to just, I mean, if we're walking through the cast, is there a better movie dad than Paul Dooley? Between this and Breaking Away, this is like, I feel like the movie dad that everyone would like to have. And that scene, that middle of the night scene on the couch was just, is just so sweet and so tender. What do you got, Mike?
Finish your statement, because I got a story to tell you about that scene, but finish everything you have to say, please.
All I was going to add was just in prepping for the show and doing the research, I read that John Hughes offered the role to Paul Dooley. He turned it down because there wasn't a whole lot for him to play, because at that point in the script, it was basically just the stuff at the beginning and the stuff at the end. And so John Hughes went and wrote that scene specifically to get Paul Dooley to come be in his movie. And so he sent it to Paul Dooley, and Paul Dooley read the scene and said, okay, I'll come be in your movie. And that was how he ended up with him playing the role. What were you going to say?
Well, I learned something very interesting about that movie today.
Okay.
There's a podcast that came out recently called White Canon, that just started recently called White Canon. And it's, it's two hosts, a white guy and a black guy. One of them is the guy that started Movies That Made Me. So you may have heard, you know, the Movies That Made Me podcast, right? And what they do is they have guests on, you know, white and black guests on, and they talk about movies that are part of the sort of white people, like, assume everybody has seen, but most black people have never seen. This is the criteria for the show.
Got it. Okay.
Their first episode is 16 Candles and Breakfast Club, okay?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right? That's their first episode. And their first two guests are Wyatt Cenac and Daniel Waters. Okay. And so Daniel Waters, who wrote Heathers and killed John Hughes as a thing, right? As like as a genre, right? Is on the show. So like, I don't want to talk about other people's podcasts too much on my podcast, but Daniel Waters on 16 Candles is pretty fucking good. I have to say, he's got a lot of real personal feelings about 16 Candles and stories about John Hughes and all that. One of the stories that he tells on that podcast is that in the original script, the end of that scene, that wonderful, wonderful scene that is such a perfect little hinge in the middle of that movie where she forgives her father and right? Originally, the end of that scene was him saying to her, "What happened to your underpants?" Like he could like tell that she wasn't wearing them. Right.
Oh.
And then everybody, including Molly Ringwald, was like, "You gotta change that." And so now the end is like, you wear the pants in the relationship, right? That's like how it actually ends. Yeah. So like it turns into this sort of like, you're the one who sort of has the power of the choice here and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But like, yes, the faces, if you're listening to this in audio, the faces they made are the only appropriate ones to hearing that story about what was supposed to be the end of that scene. And apparently it took Molly Ringwald saying to him like, "Bro, no. Nah." And like the scene doesn't have to be as heartfelt and touching and warm and lovely as it is, for that to not be the right end, right? Yes. It doesn't need to, it can be a throwaway scene. That's still the wrong ending. But it you're going to put that fucking turd on the end of this beautiful piece of cake you just served me? Like, anyway, that was a shock. I was shocked to hear that. Had to relate that back. Check out White Cannon.
Good to know. Good to know. We'll link it in the show notes. Alana, anything else you wanted to add about 16 Candles and your love for it before we move on to release and reception?
No, I think I'm good.
Good. All right. Great. Great soundtrack too. We should mention that. The music supervised by Jimmy Iovine credit leapt out at me this time as I was watching that.
Nobody had ever heard of him in 1984. Yeah, but you have now.
Yeah. Popped right out during that very 1980s opening.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Credit sequence. Okay, let's take a quick break and then we'll talk about the movie's release and reception. All right, friends, let's talk about the release and reception of 16 Candles, which opened nationwide on May 4th, 1984. It shared a direct release date with Breakin', speaking of quintessentially 80s movies, as well as Alphabet City, Purple Hearts, and The Bounty, starring Anthony Hopkins, yay, and Mel Gibson, boo. Also, in New York theaters that weekend, Romancing the Stone, Moscow on the Hudson, Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter, This is Spinal Tap, Police Academy, Splash, Penelope Spheris's Suburbia, Swing Shift, Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Racing with the Moon, and the much-valued re-release of Hitchcock's The Man Who Knew Too Much. 1983's Best Picture winner Terms of Endearment was still in theaters, as was Ingmar Bergman's Fanny and Alexander, its 47th week, according to the ad, because we used to let movies find an audience in theaters, but I digress. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
Wow, can you believe the last Friday the 13th movie came out in 1984?
I know, The Final Chapter. It was all over with movie number 4. That shit held for literally a year. Friday the 13th Part 5, A New Beginning, came out in 1985. That's how fast they were holding to the idea of ending that cash cow. Sorry, what was in the news that day, sir?
Friday, May 4, 1984, the Soviet Union were stepping up their efforts to rein in militants in Afghanistan. I wonder how that worked out.
Yeah, I'm sure that went fine. That sounds like a good idea. Yeah.
Something that's been doable at any time over totally the last 3,000 manageable. Years.
Yeah. Totally manageable. Yep.
President Reagan was defending his choice for ambassador to El Salvador against Senator Jesse Helms. You want to hear a story where you and Jesse Helms are on the same side?
I did not think I would ever hear that.
Of course you don't. Neither did I. But you know what? Here we are. I had to. You do too. Helms
okay,
was
I'm
big
ready.
Mad at Ambassador Thomas J. Pickering and accusing him of all kinds of dirty deeds, including interfering in El Salvador's presidential election. Reagan insisted it wasn't true, but Pickering is the Forrest Gump of the 80s, bro. Look at wherever the worst shit on earth is happening, and he just left. You know, like he's like one, like 3 days behind Zelig, you know, anyway, it's crazy to say out loud, but Helms was probably right on this one. On literally nothing else, but he was right on this one.
You know what? Broken clock twice a day. Blind squirrel eventually finds a nut, whatever cliche you want to drop into that. That's fine with me.
And finally, Pope John Paul II went to South Korea and said he hoped the two halves of the peninsula could be reunited through dialogue, mutual trust, and brotherly love. But then the Koreans were all like, nobody here is Catholic, bro. Please go away. That's headlines.
Thank you.
Jason, thank you, what did the critics have to say about 16 Candles?
Well, let's lead off with our pal Pauline Kael, who wrote in The New Yorker, quote, 16 Candles is about suburban Chicago teenagers, but it's less raucous in tone than most of the recent teen pictures. It's closer to the gentle English comedies of the 40s and 50s. It doesn't amount to much, and it's certainly not to be confused with a work of art or a work of any depth, but the young writer-director John Hughes has a knack for making you like the high school-age characters better each time you hear them talk. David Denby, writing for New York Magazine, opined, 16 Candles, the new teen dating comedy, is an odd mixture of brutality and tenderness. Screenwriter John Hughes, directing for the first time, shoves his minor characters around as if they were dirty trays in a cafeteria. He revels in the kind of crude obliviousness that kids love precisely because it's so insistently dumb. Yet, Hughes has created a lovely heroine, Samantha, Molly Ringwald, and he treats her as delicately as he might a princess opening her first ball. His affection for her redeems the picture.
That's one thing we talked about in that show, in that podcast that I hadn't really thought much about, is that Molly Ringwald was not necessarily considered unattractive, but like the sort of the picture is the popular guy's girlfriend.
Right.
You know, it's that sort of Lonnie
Anderson character. Or her sister. Like, same thing. That's sort of like 80s blonde bombshell sort of thing.
And so Molly Ringwald is like not necessarily unattractive, but is definitely like odd.
Unconventional.
In that, you know, sort of, which like she's just cute as a button. And like, I don't know, like it's sort of, that hadn't occurred to me until I heard them talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, redheads have always had to battle the blondes for dominance. It's fine. At the Times, Janet Maslin summed it up well. John Hughes's 16 Candles is a cuter and better natured teen comedy than most, with the kinds of occasional lapses in taste that probably can't hurt it in the cities for which it is intended. The middle of the film wastes time on a bit more house wrecking and car crashing than is absolutely necessary, and there are some notably unfunny ethnic jokes. Maslin had a curve on that one. Yeah. But most of the movie is cheerful and light, showcasing Mr. Hughes' knack for remembering all those aspects of middle-class American adolescent behavior that anyone else might want to forget.
And she just wrote one sentence describing the rest of his career. Nailed it. Nailed it. One
succinct
sentence, first movie, first succinct review. Bung. Here's the rest of your life. Enjoy it.
I mean, when you're writing for print, you gotta keep it tight. But there were some detractors. Notably, the Village Voice's David Edelstein, who wrote, quote, the gruesomely unfunny 16 Candles was written and directed by John Hughes, who wrote Mr. Mom. In his debut as an auteur, he embraces traditional high school stereotypes with unprecedented fervor, as if to transcend them with sheer tacky overstatement. He creates an artificial universe dictated by the snap judgments of an obnoxious teenage girl, end quote. I've often disagreed with Mr. Edelstein, and I disagree with this, mostly because I think that the key point here that's incorrect, sorry to backtrack a bit, is the idea of that he embraces the traditional high school stereotypes as if that's all he does is embrace them. And I feel like the genius of this movie, and then you see him take it to the sort of next step in Breakfast Club, is the idea of like, these stereotypes exist, let's examine them, let's transcend them, let's subvert them, let's understand them beyond those types. And like the scene in the car in the shop class between the two of them is really the emotional heart of the movie. Like that's the scene where it becomes something more than the sort of traditional high school narrative, in my humble opinion. Alana, thoughts on the use of stereotypes here?
The biggest stereotype for me was obviously Long Duck Dong in
yes
the film. And it's, I think I read that after that character, you know, after this movie came out, like a lot of people in the Asian community that were in teenagers were, you know, this character became a stereotype projected onto them and fed into a lot of certain people's experiences growing up and because of this character. And I mean, it's so unfortunate, I feel like, because there could have been a really great plot line around him that wasn't rooted in racism. And it unfortunately just is.
It just is. And the gong that just doesn't help. The that is like straight out of like a 50s. That's Breakfast at Tiffany's shit right there. How did 16 Candles do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
16 Candles opened in second place for the weekend to the aforementioned Breakin'. And come on, who can be Breakin' in 1984? Get the fuck out of here. True. It did $4.4 million that weekend on its way to a $23.6 million domestic gross, a nice return on its $6.5 million budget. No major award wins, but casting director Jackie Birch was nominated for Best Casting for a Feature Film from the Casting Society of America. I'm going to say she earned that one. Well earned.
Yeah, right. Jackie Birch. This is just a little like, look up Jackie Birch on IMDb sometime. Discover how many of your favorite fucking movies Jackie Birch cast. The name leapt out at me because I'm researching a Die Hard book right now. And guess who the casting director was on that one? Guess who thought, let's put Bruce Willis and Bonnie Bedelia and all of these people in Die Hard. That's shout out to Jackie Birch on The Big Show.
Molly Ringwald and Anthony Michael Hall won the Best Young Actress and Best Young Actor in a Motion Picture Awards at the Young Artist Awards. Also worth noting, in 2015, Entertainment Weekly ranked the 50 best high school movies. 16 Candles came in 8th place. Any guesses what came in number one?
Alana, what do you got?
Breakfast Club?
Gotta be. As if there was any other choice. They weren't going to do like Dazed and Confused.
That I think was like number 3. It was very high on the list.
Oh, really?
Well. Yeah.
All right, I take that back.
It did quite well. Alana, do you prefer, I see we have a cat visitor. If you're not watching on YouTube, you're missing great cat work right now by Alana. What's Breakfast Club or 16 Candles, what's your preference? What's your personal preference?
16 Candles still. I
agree.
The rom-com element is stronger for me in it, and that's what always draws. I'm just a rom-com head, so I appreciate The Breakfast Club as well. Like, I like it, but it's just, I also feel like there's, you know, a sentimental aspect for me. Like, it was my mom who's the one who got me to watch it with her every time it was on, and it's the first rom-com I saw, so.
You know, we didn't go into personal histories earlier, but I have such a clear memory of seeing this because this movie, this was a very early, maybe one of our first VHS rentals when we got our VHS tape deck, a story I told on a previous episode. And I mean, here's how, like, there was not like a video store in our immediate area yet. We had to go to the Quick Trip, which was like the 7-Eleven, like a convenience store. They had like a shelf of movies that they would rent. And the night that my dad went in, literally everything was checked out except 16 Candles. So that was how he brought home 16 Candles and how we watched it for the first time. And then afterwards he was like, well, I don't know why that was the only one that was left. That's a pretty good movie. All right, it's time for a segment we like to call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Alana, you're our guest, which means you go first.
I feel like if we're the more obvious ones are like Say Anything. Another like 80s rom-com. Obviously, we got John Cusack in it.
And Joan.
The Breakfast Club.
Sure.
Another Brat Pack movie. But in terms of like a more, I want to say contemporary one, that said, I think it came out in like 99. My other suggestion was Drive Me Crazy with Melissa Joan Hart. Because I do feel like there is that, you know, popular girl geek dynamic and, you know, there's like some scheming.
That one makes sense. That's a good one. I thought this over, and the one that I kept landing on was a very contemporary one. The Edge of 17, starring Hailee Steinfeld. Like, I feel like when you're talking about sort of the clear cinematic offspring of Samantha Baker, like Hailee Steinfeld's character in Edge of 17 that's a pretty direct line, like in terms of the character's cynicism, her wit, the degree to which she feels like an outsider, to which she feels sort of abandoned, the family issues that become very pressing over the course of that film. I think, you know, the writer director of that particular film, whose name has of course escaped me right now, but who also did the film adaptation of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I feel like she is a filmmaker, one of the few who I think sort of earns the comparison to Hughes in terms of the intelligence and the wit that she grants to her teen characters without making them sort of unbelievably or disproportionately wise or funny or spouting sitcom lines or things like that. Kelly Freeman Craig, I looked it up as I was babbling, I think is fantastic. I think she's a terrific writer director. And I hope she keeps doing things because she's fantastic. So that's my pick, Edge of 17. Mike, what about you?
Something that I have found that I've really enjoyed in these picking a double feature thing, which is different mm-hmm. for some, feels different from than recommending the way we did mm-hmm. in A Very Good Year, where we're like, oh, I like this movie from that year. Double right. feature is a different category.
It's oh,
a different
totally.
Thought process in a way Absolutely. That didn't really occur to me. So I've been doing a lot of sort of comparison things where, like, you know, put these two movies together and compare some specific element. Mm-hmm. So I ended up looking around at the director of photography for this movie because, like, there were so many. This movie is like interestingly shot in ways yeah. that it didn't have to be, and in mm-hmm. ways that it really sort of never get talked about. Mm-hmm. You know, the lighting is not, you know, the lighting is sort, I mean, not flat. I wouldn't say it's flat, but it's rom-com. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
everything is lit. You can see the hell out of everything, you know, but like there's a lot of sort of depth to it. Anyway, I was like, what else did this guy do? Do you know what else he shot?
Hmm.
Gentleman by the name of Bobby Byrne.
Okay.
Is a director of photography on this movie. Mm-hmm. His very first major feature film credit
mm-hmm.
is Smokey and the Bandit. And oh! I'm not going to necessarily recommend Smokey and the Bandit, but talk about another like interestingly filmed movie.
Yeah.
You know, that he also shot Blue Collar, dude.
Holy
shit. The guy
shit.
That shot 16 Candles shot Blue Collar.
Okay.
All right. So if you'd like to see a comparison contrast in how a guy approaches two completely different central characters and storylines, there they are.
Yeah.
But while I was looking through it, I came to my actual double up, which is with a movie called California Dreaming that came out in 1979. Have you ever seen California Dreaming?
No.
California Dreaming. California Dreaming is... it is actually a pretty good double up with 16 Candles because it's like, but it's a male central character and it's this just sort of like dork from the Midwest who goes to California and tries to like hang out with some surfer girls.
Okay.
It's a sort of 70s like teen rom-com, you know, instead of an 80s one, but it's actually like, it feels, you know, it feels actually sort of more like 16 Candles than... I don't know. It's been a while. I hadn't thought about it in a long time, but I had seen it once upon a time. And California Dreamin' is a pretty good movie. And like he's outside, he's in California. It's sort of the same thing, but it's a completely different locale. It's a completely different sort of approach to cinematography. So like, I don't know, it's like the one angle of this movie that it hasn't been sort of beaten to death is who shot it and how.
Yeah.
Right. I feel like in a lot of ways, like we didn't really talk about The Breakfast Club as we were talking about this movie, because that's so, we didn't really talk about like St. Elmo's Fire, because like obviously there's plenty of ways to go hear other people talk about sort of comparing this movie to St. Elmo's Fire, right? Like that's why we didn't do any of that stuff. But California Dreamin', I think, is actually a new angle on it.
Okay. I mean, I'd have been fine with you pairing
that
it
with
Blue.
That felt sort of defensive in a weird way.
No, no.
Sure
I mean,
I needed to feel defensive about that.
I'd have been fine with you pairing it with Blue Collar. Like, you know, every once in a while that meme will go around on social media where it'd be like, you know, same cinematographer, two movies, and they'll put up the two posters and someone's always like, you know, Cool as Ice and Schindler's List or whatever. I mean, I don't think 16 Candles and Blue Collar is quite that much of a contrast, but it's in the same
pretty
general
close.
Vicinity. Fem general pretty vicinity. Close. All right. Thank you, Mike. Alana, where can people follow you on social media and read your work these days?
So you can follow me on Instagram, Blue Sky, and Twitter, unfortunately, still, at Lonnie Caps. It's LaniKaps. Also, TikTok, same name. I just don't post on there that often.
There we go. I am Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
I am Fifth Column Films on Blue Sky.
And of course, if you like the show and you think other folks might like it too, please do leave us a rating and a review on your podcatcher of choice. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get weekly show notes and such, you can do that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. If you'd like to make a donation to support us in the show, you can do that at ko-fi.com/funcitysounds. And if you're one of those weirdos who loves watching videos of people recording a podcast, hello, find us on YouTube on our channel, Danny Perry Rocks.
Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic, and shout out to executive producer Blake Howard, who's been here for 5 hours and he's got somebody. We live here our whole lives and we're like a disease.
Thank you again, Alana Kaplan.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. Join us next time for our first two-guest double feature show, in which These Fists Break Bricks authors Grady Hendrix and Chris Pagali will be here to talk about Enter the Dragon and Five Fingers of Death. Gonna be a good one. See you then.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.